My sense is that a physicist's definition of nothing is very different from the layman's idea of nothing. So what is your understanding of nothing?
Well, you hit the nail on the head, in fact. Science has completely changed the way we think about many things that we thought we understood or thought made common sense. And to a physicist, nothing, with the first version of nothing that you might think of is just simply empty space with nothing in it. You get rid of all the particles, all the radiation, so there's literally nothing in it. But that nothing is actually quite complicated. Because of quantum mechanics and relativity, it turns out that empty space is a boiling, bubbling brew of virtual particles popping in and out of existence in a timescale so short you can't even measure them. So nothing is actually quite complicated, at least that version of nothing. It sounds like almost like philosophy or theology to talk about things that are you can't measure. But in fact, while we can't measure those virtual particles that are popping in and out of existence directly, we can measure their effects indirectly. And in fact, they're responsible for some of the best predictions in all of physics. So we know they're there. So that kind of nothing is not that kind of empty space and that kind of nothing is not as uncomplicated as we thought before.
It sounds then like this idea of nothing is very different than, I think, what philosophers and theologians would say. I mean, I think their idea of nothing would be along the lines of non-existence or non-being.
That's true. But I don't exactly know what those words mean. It seems to me that nothing is a physical quantity just like something is, and we need to look to the universe to ask what it is. Now, it is true that there is nothing, there is literally nothing physical in empty space, and you might say, therefore, there is nothing existing in empty space directly because you measure it and there's nothing there. It turns out, however, just like quantum mechanics is counterintuitive, nothing, where there's nothing there, actually can produce something quite easily. But from a physical point of view, one can get a little closer to that vague and I would say ill-defined version of non-being that philosophers and theologians might have argued about for thousands of years by saying, well, in fact, there are other versions of nothing, and in fact, you can imagine no space and no time, which, of course, I think is a better version of non-being and non-existence. But if we apply the laws of quantum mechanics to gravity, and we don't yet have a theory of quantum gravity, but any theory of quantum gravity, we know space itself will become a dynamical variable that's subject to quantum mechanics. And in that theory, even space itself can pop into existence spontaneously, space and time, where there were no space and time before. And I think no space and no time is certainly, again, a much closer version of the nothing of say, some philosophers and theologians. Although I would have argued, by the way, that if you look at the Bible or something, that an eternal empty void was their version of nothing, which I would say is empty space. But that even then, even if you get rid of space and time, some people may argue even that is not nothing. Because if there are laws operating, if there are laws of physics operating, then somehow that still isn't non-being. I have a harder time with that argument, because if there's nothing there, if there's no space and no time, to me it's nothing. But it turns out, even based on some ideas that are coming at the forefront of physics, as space and time might come into existence, it turns out even the laws of physics themselves, as we know them, might come into existence. They might be unique to each universe. And so you've got no particles, no space, no time, no laws. Boy, that's pretty close to what I think anyone would argue is nothing. But, you know, if it doesn't satisfy those who think that that's non-being, so be it. But I'm much more interested in the nothing of the actual universe than some vague a priori definition of what non-being is. I don't know how to define non-being except to look out at nature and ask, what's the difference between having something there and having nothing there?
Well, your book makes the argument that science can finally answer the basic age-old existential question, why is there something rather than nothing? Can you explain to a non-physicist how the universe can be created out of nothing?
Yeah, and by the way, let me make one thing clear. I explain how it's plausible. I think it's important, you know, sometimes I read people saying, you know, Krauss has said we know this, and you know, how dare we say we know this. The point is, what we've been able to do is, using our remarkable discoveries of the last 30 years or so, come up with a plausible series of steps by which the universe we see could have come from nothing, as I'll describe to you. But it's plausible. But even the fact that it's plausible is remarkable and worth celebrating. Just like it, in some sense, it's plausible. We don't yet understand the origin of life exactly. We don't understand how chemistry turned into biology. But I think most scientists realize it's quite plausible that chemical reactions eventually produce the precursors of organic molecules that would become the molecules of life and form biology. In any case, here's how it could have happened, okay? And as I say, the simplest possibility is that there is no space, no time. And then given what we understand about quantum gravity, about quantum mechanics and general relativity together, it is quite possible that literally a small space could pop into existence where there was none before. Normally, such spaces will pop in and out of existence in a timescale so short you can't measure them, and those universes will disappear quite quickly. But what is also remarkable is we have great evidence that in our universe, at very early times, and by very early, I mean something like a millionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second after the Big Bang, our universe puffed up by a huge amount due to, again, standard laws of physics. Energy got trapped in space, and that energy caused the universe to expand incredibly rapidly. We call that a period of inflation. And that would have puffed our universe up to be large enough so that it would essentially survive long enough so that we could be in it. And then out of empty space, due to quantum processes, in fact, all of the matter that we now see in the universe could arise, because it doesn't violate any conservation of energy, because it turns out the total energy of our universe can be precisely zero. That's perhaps one of the great discoveries of the last 40 years, is that it looks like the total energy of our universe is precisely zero. And if you were going to create a universe from nothing, that's what you'd expect. And it sounds like a scam. How can you get something from nothing? How can you get a free lunch? Well, it turns out physics allows you to get a free lunch, because once you allow gravity into the mix, you can have positive energy and negative energy. And you can trade off an empty space with no particles in it and create a space with lots of particles, lots of matter, enough to form all the 400 billion galaxies we observe in our universe today. And then the gravitational attraction between those objects produces a negative energy, so the total balance is precisely zero. And you don't need any supernatural shenanigans to do it.
Hmm. I guess what's so bizarre for the outsider, for the non-physicist hearing,
it's bizarre for me too, but
but it sounds like you're saying it's no big deal in the world of quantum physics for something to come out of nothing. It's somehow, for some reason, that's not a problem. When it, for the outsider, that seems like a huge problem.
In fact, it's not only not a problem. It would be, the much more remarkable question would be, why is there nothing rather than something, except we wouldn't be around to ask the question, because nothing is essentially unstable. Empty space, due to the laws of quantum mechanics and gravity, is unstable. If you leave it long enough, it'll always create particles. So the real point is that distinction, that common sense distinction between something and nothing, in common parlance, is not such a distinction in physics. And it's due to the weird laws of quantum mechanics. And quantum mechanics defies of all of our sort of classical common sense and our classical intuition. So if you want to find things bizarre, we can talk about many bizarre things in quantum mechanics, how particles can be in many places at the same time and be doing many different things at the same time. Everything of which defies common sense, but which experiment has demonstrated is true, is possible with quantum mechanics, and because of that, even this weird distinction between something and nothing begins to vanish. And you know, it's not so surprising. Let's step back a little bit, maybe a few 500 years or so, and think about questions that seemed profound and important, like Kepler might have asked, why are there five planets? And you know, and then he'd say, well, there are five platonic solids or something like that, some profound reason why there must be five planets. Well, now we know there aren't five planets. There are nine planets. And by the way, there are nine planets. Don't let anyone tell you Pluto isn't a planet. It'll always be a planet for me. But in any case, we know that that's not something profound. I mean, there are many solar systems, and we've discovered them. Most stars have them around them, and some of them have fewer planets, some of them have more. The more interesting question is, how are there nine planets? Namely, how did our solar system arise? And we try and understand that by looking at the different kinds of possibilities that might happen. And the really interesting questions in our universe is, how did it evolve and how did we get here? And this why question, which may have seemed so profound, has been replaced. And so it often happens in science, I think, that questions that seem to have a certain type of significance, the meaning of those words changes. And you know, it's not a scam, and it's not something we do to defeat philosophers and theologians. We do it because we take our definitions from the universe.
I have to follow up on that, because there is that common saying that theology and philosophy deal with the why questions while science deals with the how questions, because the fundamental religious question, of course, is why are we here? Are you saying those why questions should not even be asked?
Well, I think most why questions are really how questions, because if you ask why, and what you're really meaning is you're presuming purpose. you're making a presumption that there's some meaning, some purpose. Really, if you think about most why questions, they really are how questions. And I would argue that if you insist on why, you're assuming the answer before you ask the question. You're assuming there is purpose to the universe and that there's some reason that we came to exist, some reason that satisfies your classical intuition. But why should there be a reason that satisfies your classical intuition? Because your classical intuition is not right in most cases anyway. And why must there be purpose to the universe? It's science. We just try and figure out how it happened. And, you know, it would be possible to demonstrate purpose. For example, if the stars aligned tonight and I looked up and it said, I am here, I might begin to think that there's some overriding, overarching intelligence in the universe. But there's no evidence of it. And so there may be purpose to the universe, and science certainly can't answer that question ultimately in the negative. But what we can say is there's no evidence of purpose, that everything we see, as far as we can tell, came into existence by laws of physics that we can understand without any supernatural shenanigans. So those why questions, I really think, are unimportant and usually misplaced, because they essentially are how questions. And you can, of course, keep asking them, and you know, it's turtles all the way down. You can say, well, let's say our universe came into existence from some multiverse that was eternal. Why did the multiverse exist? Well, we don't know why, but if it existed eternally, so be it. There doesn't have to be a reason. There doesn't have to be a purpose. And that may disappoint some people, but in fact, I find it quite emboldening. So it energizes me to think that due to a set of accidents, remarkably, in this remote corner of a galaxy, in the remote corner of the middle of nowhere of our universe, in a remote planet, that we happen to evolve with a consciousness that can ask these questions, and we should enjoy our brief moment in the sun and realize that the meaning of our lives is the meanings we make from it, the fact that we have the opportunity to ask these questions and produce remarkable ideas and remarkable technology.
Let me just follow up on that word, okay, meaning, that you were just saying. I mean, basically you're saying that, you know, we construct our own meaning, and it does raise the question of whether science is in the business of helping us find meaning, because, of course, again, that's traditionally the domain of religion and philosophy.
Well, I think what the last few thousand years have shown us is that the domain of religion and philosophy is shrinking. In fact, I would have argued that the domain of religion shrank to zero a long time ago. Philosophy perhaps has a little more utility in trying to reflect on these ideas, but I've given theologians who I've talked to a challenge. I said, give me an example in the last 500 years where theology has contributed to human knowledge. And the only answer to that question I get is, what do you mean by knowledge? And I would say if you had a psychologist or a chemist or a biologist, they'd be able to answer that question quite easily. So I think what is amazing is, because of the astounding and remarkable developments that have taken place in science, we are being pushed to the threshold of asking questions which we may not have thought were scientific questions initially or were the domain of science. But the domain of science is to understand the universe.
So coming back to the meaning question then, can science help us with meaning in our lives? Is that in the domain of science?
I ultimately think it is in the domain of science, because if you don't understand how the world works or the consequences of your actions, how can you adequately describe anything, even morality? Science provides a basis for understanding meaning. Maybe it's the domain of philosophy at some level to ask what does science imply about our existence? And those may be philosophical questions and not scientific ones, perhaps. But science provides the basis for understanding reality. And until you understand how the world works, how on earth can you ask why?
Well, I have to say, what is especially striking about your book, A Universe from Nothing, is the way you have aligned your argument about the origins of the universe with atheism. And it's worth pointing out that Richard Dawkins wrote the afterword to your book, and Christopher Hitchens had planned to write the foreword but was unable to when his terminal cancer became too painful. And of course, neither is a physicist. They are two of the world's best-known atheists. So why turn this story of the universe's origins into an attack on religion when you did not have to go in that direction?
Well, you know, first of all, it really isn't an attack on religion. I mean, it ultimately, I think science is an attack on religion. But the purpose of the book, and I state it quite clearly, there's probably two or three pages in the book where I talk about God and people fixate on them. And we'll talk about why Richard and Christopher are involved. But the book is really a celebration of our understanding of the universe. And that's why I write things. I don't write things to attack God because I don't think God's important enough to attack, frankly. I think what is amazing is understanding reality. I think ultimately, when we understand reality, then this need for belief in myths and superstition will go away, and that's a good thing. But I'm not an atheist. I'm more along the lines of Christopher, as he would have called himself an anti-theist. Namely, I cannot presume to say there is, with certainty, no God. But what I can say with certainty is I wouldn't want to live in a universe with one. I wouldn't want to live in a universe with a cosmic Saddam Hussein who wasn't content to just torture people during their lives, but for all eternity.
That is not how most people, most religious people, define God as a cosmic Saddam Hussein.
Religion fulfills some human need, there's no doubt about it. But what most people do is they pick and choose their theology to please themselves. Most of them don't buy all the doctrines of their religions because the doctrines are so silly and so full of things that are clearly impossible or disagree with the evidence of reality. Most people don't stone their children for disobeying them if they like the Old Testament. People inevitably pick those aspects of religion that they find soft and comforting and welcoming. But inevitably, that throws out most of the doctrine. And one of the reasons I chose Richard and asked Christopher was because if I'd asked physicists, I think this stuff, our understanding of the universe is so remarkable, it deserves to be shared more broadly. And what I wanted to do was ask people who weren't physicists to comment on this stuff because it would indicate to people that you know, you don't have to be a physicist to be interested in it. Now, it does have implications for this age-old question. And one of the reasons I wrote the book and to celebrate this is after talking about this for years and refining arguments and continuing to be amazed by the discoveries of the universe, I inevitably get thrown this question by people who say, yeah, but, you know, science can't address this question. And they inevitably do it for religious reasons. And I do think science will play the role over time, inevitably, of getting rid of myth and superstition. The scriptures, the books, the world's great religions were written by people who didn't even know the earth went around the sun. So how could they know anything about the world that's sensible? To take your ideas of truth from people who were largely illiterate, who believed in monsters and shadows, I think is a disservice. As my friend Steve Weinberg would put it, it's an assault on human dignity. And to me, the greatest dignity is realizing that you know, we may be here alone, and it's up to us to not only understand our world, but to try and take care of it.
Well, you are not just hard on religion and theology. Your book has also sparked a very public spat between physicists and philosophers. And at one point you say some of modern philosophy is intellectually bankrupt. Why are you so hard on philosophers of science?
Well, it's grown, I think. Look, I have many good friends who are philosophers, but my point is that I don't believe we can make great progress understanding nature or even understanding ourselves by turning inward, by defining words, by using classical logic, by arguing on the basis of ideas that really were developed by people, once again, who really didn't understand the universe. I think we have to turn to the universe for truth. And there's many, many philosophers who base their discussions, their reflections on science. There are, however, those who think that we can define our understanding and interpret it in terms of definitions, a priori definitions of words and concepts that are hundreds or thousands of years old. I think that area of philosophy is intellectually bankrupt, and it borders on theology. And you've got to ask the question, what contributions to knowledge have been made? And I think it's quite clear that science has way outpaced philosophy in many, many areas. Of course, I'm provocative at times, and partly I was provoked. But I think we have to, I guess I have this one, I think I would go so far as to say I'm not yet convinced there is any knowledge but empirical knowledge. And that would probably put me in a camp that's different than some people. I think, but we can only really claim to know things that we can empirically test. And we can reflect on those, and we can gain insights and wisdom. But unless we reflect on reality, then we're just playing mind games, in my opinion.
Okay, well, I have to ask you about that scathing review of your book in the New York Times Book Review by the philosopher of science, David Albert, who, it's worth pointing out, has a PhD in physics. And it comes back to
this. But he's not
this,
a physicist, he's a philosopher.
Right.
That's worth pointing out, too.
Right. It comes back to this discussion of what nothing means. And he said, you have not answered the basic problem of something coming out of nothing because you don't explain where those quantum fields came from in the first place, or why the laws of physics are the way they are. For instance, why we have quantum mechanics, why that even
exists. Yeah, I think he should
have
read the book before reviewing it. I think it would have helped that review immensely if he'd actually read more than the preface and the afterword.
So, I mean, his point is that you don't answer the core philosophical question, which is first cause.
Yeah, well, in fact, I try very carefully to say what I do and don't do. And moreover, I think what he said is, Lawrence Krauss didn't write the book I would have liked to have written about some other subject, and therefore I'm going to review that book that I would have liked to have written. There's clearly, what amazed me about that is my book is about cosmology. I talk about the amazing discoveries. The word isn't even mentioned in the review, nor is there any concept that isn't mentioned in the preface or the afterwards. And to review a book because he doesn't have to like Richard Dawkins amazed me. But let's go back to that question. I actually do describe exactly how it's possible that quantum fields that can come into existence. Namely, if there's no space and no time, then in fact those fields did not exist in our space and our time. Now, as I point out, the laws of physics themselves may have come into existence. Did quantum mechanics come into existence at the same time? I don't know. And I try and point out clearly the questions that I know and don't know, and nowhere do I make the claim that we did anything other than what I described, that everything we see could have arisen out of no space and no time. And if that's not the question he wanted answered, too bad. I think for most people, operationally, the mystery of why is there something rather than nothing, the apparent miracle is how everything we see could have arisen when there was no stuff originally and maybe no universe originally. That seems to be the paradox. And science can maybe address that question. Now, that may not be the question that some people want addressed, but for me, that question is remarkable, and I make it pretty clear that that's the question I'm trying to address. I even point out very clearly that I'm ultimately addressing the how question and not the why question. So I try, after having discussed this for years with people, to be pretty careful. I believe if you're writing a science book, you have to be very honest and say what we know and what we don't know, and I try pretty carefully to define the different versions of nothing that I describe. And if none of those are the nothing that he likes, that's too bad. But I think that I'm honest about describing what can happen. And in fact, the apparent miracles that amaze people are the very miracles that I discuss as being, in fact, not miracles.
But I guess the question, though, is don't there have to be laws of physics for any of this stuff to happen? I mean, in maybe some sort of mathematical sense that if the universe is going to happen, there are these ways that it has to happen, and therefore the something can come out of nothing?
Well, you know, it's a good question. And in fact, for a long time, that seemed to be the case. However, let's say, and it is possible, and we've been driven to this not for some philosophical reason, but because we're trying to understand the universe we see, the quantum fluctuations that produced the galaxies and everything else, that people are driven to the idea now that, in fact, it may be that all laws of physics are possible, namely that every different kind of law you could imagine might arise in some universe that might arise and exist for a microscopic instant or an eternity, and if all different possibilities are realized, then you might say, well, each one results in something specific, but if every different possibility is realized, is that really saying that we had to happen? No, it's saying that we're an accident. And I think if every different possibility is realized, it's akin to saying that there were no laws. I mean, but you know, that's an interesting question, and it's an interesting question we may not be able to resolve. As I say, if our universe is one of potentially an infinite number of universes, some of which are popping into existence right now, then we may ask the question, why the multiverse? Is it eternal? Could it be eternal? And those questions may be interesting, and we may be able to address them in science in some way, and they they may answer that fundamental why question. But if our laws are an accident, and we happen to be here because those laws are consistent with our existence, that, by the way, isn't theological. It doesn't say the universe is fine-tuned for us. It's much more like a kind of cosmic natural selection. You know, it would be much more surprising for us to find ourselves living in a universe we couldn't live than for us to find the opposite. Much like bees can see the colors of flowers, not because they're designed to do so, but if they couldn't, then they couldn't survive and reproduce, and as natural selection has told us. So the universe, the world, looks fine-tuned for the life that lives within it. And this apparent fine-tuning is a remarkable illusion. And one of the great successes of science, it seems to me, in biology, is to point out that that illusion is understandable because of natural selection and random mutation. Well, the illusion of fine-tuning of our universe might also be understandable in terms of the laws of physics.
Well, we're really talking about a modern creation story here. And the question that's on the table is whether science has finally come up with its own version of a creation story that once and for all replaces all those religious creation stories out there. And it would seem that there are ultimately two options. Either the universe appeared at some point in time, you know, the first of the many multiverses, let's say, or it has existed forever. Would you agree that those are the two choices?
Absolutely. But I think the same is true of religion. I mean, let me point out that science is more than a story. And by the way, it has replaced the creation myths of religion. Long ago, it replaced those creation myths as we understood the universe is 13.7 billion years old and not 6,000 years old, and it wasn't created in 7 days, et cetera, et cetera. But I would argue that, you know, the same questions that you could throw at science, what, you know, is the multiverse eternal and why is it eternal? God is just an intellectual cop-out for lazy minds. They basically say, look, that fundamental question of how it came into existence is so difficult, I'm going to assume some incredible intelligence, and by the way, I won't even ask the question, how did that incredible intelligence come into being? I'll just say it had to be around forever because I can't have any other explanation. It seems to me that that's just intellectually lazy. It's just like saying, you know, I see these unusual things in the sky and they have to be aliens of intelligence because I can't understand them any other way. And so it's intellectually lazy now. It wasn't intellectually lazy when religion first came up with it because there was no science. In fact, before science, everything was a miracle. In fact, again, to quote Steve Weinberg, it's not that science makes it impossible to believe in God. The remarkable thing about science is it makes it possible to not believe in God. And that is an amazing development and one worth celebrating.
So to put the question of God aside, let's just forget about religion for the time being.
Yeah, by the way, we should forget about religion because in spite of the fact that we've focused on it and people continue to, the thing I really want to point out is God is irrelevant to science. It never comes up in scientific meetings. It's never discussed. God is completely irrelevant. But anyway, go on.
So getting back to these two choices, either the universe appeared at some point, there's a beginning moment, or it has existed forever.
Well, our universe did have a beginning moment.
Right, but we know that. I mean, 13.7 billion years ago, roughly.
Not even roughly, 13.7, where all the decimal places are significant. That's amazing.
Anyway. So the question then is, I mean, this gets very speculative, of course, because we don't really know whether we're in a multiverse or not, but would you believe that there was one original universe, whether it's ours or another universe, or whether this has just been going on forever?
Well, first of all, I don't like to use the word believe. I don't think it's a relevant word for science. But so you're absolutely right. When we begin to get to certain questions, they become speculative. And everything I know about science suggests that, in fact, there probably is an eternal multiverse of which our universe is a part. And, you know, the word universe, by the way, I should say, has changed its definition in the last 50 years. It used to be the universe, by definition, was everything. Now we have a much more operational definition. Our universe is everything we could have once interacted with or may one day interact with. And it could be that there are infinite regions we could never interact with. And we now say it doesn't make sense to call them part of our universe. And in those regions, the laws of physics could have been different. But everything I know about science, as I try and describe in the book, in some sense, is suggestive that certainly there are different universes with different laws of physics, and ours is nothing special. And that's also fascinating and wonderful.
So just if I understand what you're saying, your best guess is that these multiverses, multiple universes, have been around forever.
The fact that there are multiple universes, that there could have been universes, could be around forever, absolutely. But it's a guess, as you point out. And in science, we say it's likely or not likely. We almost never say we know something with certainty, or we know it to be absolutely, well, we know certain things to be absolutely false, but we can never prove anything to be absolutely true. So my best guess is, in fact, the multiverse is eternal, but certainly our universe popped into it 13.7 billion years ago. I would love to be wrong. Because that's the other thing people don't realize about science is that, you know, it's great to be wrong because it means we learn something. And one of the reasons I do this is not because I feel I have all the right answers, but because I want to be surprised. And every day I'm surprised if I'm not surprised.
Well, there's another question here as well. I think this is just a question about science. Is the universe ultimately knowable? And we could narrow that down to the beginning, the very beginnings of the universe. Because it would seem that one very legitimate response for both a scientist and an atheist would be to say, no, there will be some fundamental mysteries beyond the capacity of science to explain.
Well, there may be. I mean, as you know, I wrote a book about Richard Feynman, and Feynman would say, you know, maybe the laws of physics are like an onion. You just keep peeling back, and there are infinite number of layers, and we never, you know, have a theory of everything. And that could be the case. But it doesn't matter. Each day we learn more about the universe. I suspect there will be mysteries forever, and there will be because we are limited in our knowledge, maybe because of the makeup of our brains, but more importantly, because we're limited in what we can see. We happen to find ourselves existing 13.7 billion years after the Big Bang. If we'd existed a few seconds after the Big Bang, maybe there's observables that would have told us more about the universe than we know now, or maybe 100 billion years from now. And so if we're limited by our empirical evidence, we'll probably be limited in what we can know, and there will be eternal mysteries. But that makes life even more fascinating, it seems to me, than presuming that you know everything by saying that God exists. That's just boring and tedious.
That is a wonderful place to leave it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was a fascinating discussion. I appreciate it.